Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to improve your American English skills with As It Is from VOA. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. It's nice to have you with us today. If you like cars, you will like today's show. We will take you to the one city in the United States that always comes to mind when we talk about automobiles. How would you like to be in a room with 500 new models of cars? Stay with us. Then we're off to the busy city of Nairobi, Kenya, where there seems to be a major problem with the way some important buildings are being constructed. This one is about safety. There you have it, two interesting stories about things that are happening in our world as it is. Let's get started. The 2015 North American International Auto Show recently took a test drive in Detroit, Michigan. It was the first major international car show in the United States this year. Automobile manufacturers from around the world presented over 500 car models. Many manufacturers featured cars powered by electricity. But lower oil prices still keep cars powered by gasoline popular among drivers. Jonathan Evans reports.
Aaron Bragman is a car expert who works for Cars.com. He says many car ideas seemed to be popular at this year's auto show.
We're seeing a lot of variety of product, luxury vehicles, electric vehicles, concept cars now apparently are making a comeback. So there's no one theme except that, you know, the industry is back.
Mary Barra is the chief executive officer of General Motors. She presented the company's new electric car called the Chevy Bolt. The Chevy Bolt may be the first fully electric car that will be popular with drivers. It can go longer than most other electric cars, 320 kilometers before it needs to be recharged. It also costs around $30,000, about the average price for a new car in the U.S. And, Mary Barra says, the Chevy Bolt is also more functional than any other electric vehicle on the market.
Trust me, this is no stripped-down science experiment. The Bolt EV concept offers unexpected functionality and technology with proportions and flexibility of a crossover. It's an all-electric vehicle for the real world.
The Chevy Bolt will be available to consumers after 2017. But the U.S. market may see another futuristic car as early as this year. The small car maker Local Motors plans to introduce a vehicle called the Strati. The car has a 3D printed body. The motor and other parts are based on designs by the French automobile manufacturer Renault. Jay Rogers is the CEO of Local Motors. He says printing the electric car takes about 44 hours.
We hope by the end of the year to be closer to 24 hours, and then we'd hope to be able to get it down to somewhere between 10 and 12 hours total.
A lot of new models with gas engines are more expensive. German automobile manufacturer Mercedes presented its new four-door sedan, the GLE Coupe. Porsche exhibited a new car model called the 911 Targa 4 with a 430-horsepower engine. And American car manufacturer Ford presented its first muscle car in more than 10 years, its GT supercar. The supercar has a more fuel-efficient engine than other cars like it on the market. The car also has more than 600 horsepower. The Japanese manufacturers of the Acura presented what it called a super hybrid vehicle, the NSX. It has three electric motors, providing more than 550 horsepower. The NSX can run in four different modes: quiet, sport, sport plus, or track. Each mode creates a different engine sound. The 2015 North American International Auto Show ended January 25th. Organizers have not yet decided where next year's auto show will take place. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Two buildings collapsed recently in Nairobi, the Kenyan capital. Now, many Kenyans are worried about the safety of buildings around the country. Officials from the National Construction Authority are traveling around the country and inspecting building projects. The NCA says it has forced 500 such projects to suspend work since August. Some of the closures were for safety reasons. Others were ordered because inspectors found poor quality building materials. Christopher Cruz reports.
Crispus Ndinyo is an engineer who works as an inspector for the National Construction Authority. He spoke to VOA during a visit to Kitengala, a town near Nairobi. He said he is finding violations wherever he looks.
They don't have any clothing, no helmet. I see this particular worker, even the eyes, they are very red. This means this worker, even the hands, is operating an environment that's very unsafe, very unhealthy.
Buildings are going up so quickly across Kenya that inspectors cannot examine all of the construction projects. But they say when they do find illegal activity, they order the work stopped and sometimes require the building to be destroyed.
So, at the moment, we are going to stop the construction of this particular site.
Earlier this month, a woman and small child died when a seven-floor building collapsed in Nairobi. 2 weeks earlier, seven people were killed when a building collapsed in Makongeni. Samuel Arachi is the acting inspector general of police. He says police may charge those responsible with a crime.
For this incident, everybody was involved in the construction, right from the engineers, the architects, the contractor, and the owner. To us, this is criminal negligence, and it will not be condoned.
Past building collapses have taken place in Nairobi neighborhoods where many poor people live. In those areas, buildings go up quickly with little supervision. Architecture professor Alfred Omenya says inspectors and government officials are often paid to look the other way. He says their actions have led to structures that fail to meet rules for safety.
There's a big issue, there's a big elephant in the room, the corruption, that even when these people are there, they're able to allow a whole lot of substandard practices, a whole lot of illegal practices, because, of course, they're actually able to extort bribes and they're not serious about, doing their work.
The group Transparency International follows corruption around the world. It says Kenya's police are the most corrupt government agency in Kenya. It says the country's Land Services Agency, which includes the Construction Inspection Service, is the next most corrupt. Officials have promised to increase inspections of construction projects and of existing housing, especially in the capital. They hope to prevent another deadly collapse. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Cambodia's grade 12 students took their final test in August 2014. Only 26% of them passed. The new Minister of Education had ordered extra security around the testing places. Students could not bring cell phones or calculators into the rooms. Teachers did not have the chance to tell students the answers to the exam questions. The government employed monitors to watch the test takers carefully. Why was last year different from earlier years? Heng Chun Naran entered office as education minister in 2014. He wants to end corruption in Cambodia's schools. He thinks that education reform is necessary for Cambodia's economic development.
So the most important factor is that the school skill mismatch in Cambodia, and it become an obstacle to economic development, to growth, to attracting foreign direct investment. So we have, you know, investor coming in, they look for skilled labor force. We don't have enough. But at the supply side, we have many graduates that cannot find job. And this is a problem that many countries are facing, the skill mismatch.
Students who failed were permitted to take the test again in October. The government and schools tried to help these students improve their scores. The second time around, about 18% of the students passed the test. Students taking the test in 2015 know they will have to study hard in order to do well on the test. In the past, some teachers would sell the exam questions to students. Mr. Naran's new policies included better pay and training for teachers. Teachers now earn an average of 550,000 riel a year. That is about $137 in American money. In May 2015, their minimum salary will increase to 650,000 riel, or about $162. The overall budget for education will increase to $440 million. New training will help educators better teach critical thinking and problem-solving skills. There is much room for improvement in Cambodian schools. The usual primary school class has 46 students to one teacher. This is the highest student-teacher ratio outside of Africa. The Asian Development Bank, or ADB, is a new resource for Cambodia's education reform. The bank is giving $90 million to Cambodia over the next 5 years. The money will be used in part on programs to help students stay in school. It will also go toward efforts to improve the quality of education. Cambodia's education reforms need support from everyone: students, parents, government, and businesses will all need to help improve schools. Both the tests and the economy will show the results. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On March 4, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president after winning a second term. The election had taken place in the Union of Northern States. The Union still followed the United States Constitution. The Confederacy of Southern States had left the Union. The South had its own Constitution. On the evening of Inauguration Day, the White House was open to the public. The party ended near midnight. Thousands of people went to see President Lincoln. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Lincoln and the American Civil War.
Lincoln was glad the celebrations were over. Now he could get back to the urgent problems that faced him. He hoped that during his second 4-year term, he could end the Civil War. He hoped he could ease the bitterness and hatred the war had brought. Lincoln hoped for an easy peace. He wanted no hangings or other brutal acts against the losers. He wanted to see Confederate soldiers go back to their homes to become peaceful citizens of a united country. Lincoln wanted the nation to grow together again.
The war could not last much longer. The South already was defeated, but Confederate leaders refused to accept defeat. General Robert E. Lee's army still held the area around Richmond, Virginia. Richmond was the Confederate capital. Lee did not believe, however, that he could hold the city much longer. His once mighty army now had less than 50,000 men. These men were tired and hungry, and they had to defend a line almost 60 kilometers long from Richmond to the city of Petersburg. There just were not enough Confederate soldiers left to fight.
Lee decided that his only hope was to give up the two cities. He would march south and join General Joe Johnston's army in North Carolina. Perhaps the two armies could defeat Union forces moving up through the state. Then they could turn to meet the army of General Ulysses Grant. This plan had little chance of success, but it would keep the Confederate armies active for a few more weeks or months. Lee soon discovered that it would not be easy to break out of the trap that Richmond and Petersburg had become. Grant's army seemed to be everywhere. Lee put 11,000 of his men into position near Grant's line. They waited for the enemy to attack. At first, the Confederates received some help from the weather. Heavy rains fell for more than a day. Many roads and fields were flooded. The Union Army could not move forward. When it did, the Confederates were ready. They pushed back the attackers.
The victory did not last long. There were 5 times more Union soldiers than Confederate soldiers. The Confederates fought hard, but could not stop them. They were forced to withdraw. The Confederates moved slowly, then more quickly, as Union troops chased them. They began to flee wildly. About half of them were captured. Grant ordered an immediate attack all along Lee's line. He was sure the line was weak. He was sure he could break it. A Union Army doctor watched the battle from a distance. He said he could see the flash of light from Confederate guns along a line 1 kilometer long. After a while, part of the line went dark, then another part, and another. Flashes of gunfire became fewer. Finally, all of the line was dark. The doctor said he knew then that the Confederate line had fallen.
General Grant had been trying to break General Lee's line for almost a year. Now he had done it. His troops raced forward to seize the railroad. Lee no longer had a way to supply his troops in Petersburg. He no longer had a quick way to move his army south. He would have to move west first, then turn south. This meant he would have to give up Richmond. The government of the Confederacy would have to go with him or be captured. Confederate President Jefferson Davis gave the order to go.
Southern soldiers began to burn military supplies they could not take from Richmond. Huge amounts of shells and gunpowder were exploded. The fires got out of control. Many buildings burned to the ground. The streets were filled with refugees trying to escape the burning city. Mobs broke into stores looking for food. Union troops quickly moved into Richmond. Then they raised the United States flag over the once proud capital of the Confederacy.
President Lincoln visited Richmond on April 4th. He visited the Confederate State House, where the rebel Congress had met. He had lunch in the Confederate White House, where Confederate President Jefferson Davis had lived. Everywhere Lincoln went, hundreds of people crowded around him. Blacks, especially, wanted to get near him. They wanted to touch the man who had made them free. At no time was any kind of hostile act made against the president.
In the next few days, Lincoln followed carefully Grant's campaign against Lee's withdrawing army. By telegraph and messenger, he was informed of every move. Lee's men marched without food. They did not have time to search for it. They could not stop. The Union army was only a day behind them. On and on they marched, many of them, weak from hunger and tired beyond belief, could go no farther. They left the road to sleep. Most never got back. Others continued to march, but many threw down their guns and equipment. Union forces attacked the moving line when they could. There were battles at such places as Amelia Courthouse, Sailor's Creek, High Bridge, and Farmville. Lee's army fought off each attack, but it was slowly bleeding and starving to death.
Lee asked one of his officers to report on the situation. "There is no situation," the officer said. "Nothing remains, General Lee, but to put your poor soldiers on their poor horses and send them home in time to plant the spring crops." Lee answered, "What would the country think of me if I did that?" "Country?" the officer cried. "There is no country. You are the country to these men. They have fought for you, without pay or food. There are still thousands of us who will die for you."
On April 7th, General Grant sent a message to General Lee. He said it was hopeless to continue the struggle. He asked for the surrender of Lee's army. Lee did not agree that the situation was hopeless. He believed there was still one small chance to escape. He wanted to reach a place called Appomattox Station. There, his men could get food. Then they could march to Lynchburg, where a railroad would carry them south to safety. But the Union Army reached Appomattox Station first. Lee and his officers decided to make a final effort to break out of the circle of Union forces. If their plan failed, Lee would have no other choice. He would have to surrender.
Lee rose early on the appointed day. He put on a new gray coat and a bright red sash. He looked as if he were going to a parade. His officers wondered. Then Lee explained, "I probably will be General Grant's prisoner. I thought I should look my best." At sunrise, Lee arrived on a hill outside the town of Appomattox Courthouse. He looked down on what was to be his final battlefield. His men fought hard and well, but they could not break through the Union line. Finally, Lee said, "There is nothing left me but to go see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. Lee was sure Grant would not demand unconditional surrender. He said, "Grant will give us good terms, as good as we have the right to demand. I can surrender this army on the condition that its members will never fight again." Lee turned his horse toward the enemy lines behind his army. He sent a message to General Grant. It said, "I now request to meet with you at such time and place as you may name to discuss the terms of the surrender of this army."
The place would be a home in a town called Appomattox Courthouse. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOALearningEnglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.